Hey everybody, this is your host, Michael Rice. We have a special program note for this episode, episode number 25. We recorded the show on Sunday, and towards the end of the episode, we discussed the news that Beverly Sills was gravely ill. And we talked a little about her, very little bit about her career. We had discussed it, of course, in a previous episode when she had a documentary air on PBS a few months ago. But we certainly, you know, we wished her well and hoped that she'd be able to pull through, though we all kind of knew, I think, that the end was probably near, unfortunately. And it's really, it's sad to see her go. She is the end, really is the end of an era when, you know, opera singers were people who were on the minds of the masses. Everybody knew Beverly Sills. When she would go on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, when she would be on Merv Griffin, when she would be on Joe Franklin's show in New York. You know, they would have her on just to have her on because she was a great guest and a great person and had great things to say. They didn't ask her about how fun it was to wear costumes or how do you learn how to sing in all those languages and other, you know, asinine questions, at least I think, that we get from people today. So we really will miss Beverly Sills a great deal. Rest in peace. Hope you enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to Opera Now, the Opera Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Rice. Today is Sunday, July 1st. Can't believe it, summer is, the days were already getting shorter and shorter. Summer started a couple weeks ago, but it's a beautiful night here in the city of Chicago. Taste of Chicago is going on over by Grand Park, so people are eating ribs and sausage and pizza and bears and bulls. Into sacks. So, let me go ahead and introduce our panelists today. We have got Kevin Keyes.
Howdy, everybody.
Mr. Greg Peebles.
Yoo-hoo.
Oliver Camacho.
Hi.
And the lovely Roberta Rice.
Hello.
Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
I apologize. Roberta's sound may be a little wonky tonight. Some kind of Skype Mac issue, but we'll resolve it for next week. Let's jump in. First of all, the first thing I want to do, Oliver, is I know you were recently returned from the Boston Early Music Festival. And I was wondering if you could give us a quick summation of your experience there. You're our man on the scene.
I was a roving reporter at the Boston Early Music Festival. I had the time of my life.
Did you have to wear body armor?
It was optional. It was optional this year. You know, this is my cup of tea, and I'm always promoting early music on this podcast. And really, I was like having the best geek joy of my life. Like, I was just surrounded by all these people who really got me and who really like understood where I was going as a person. And it was just so fantastic. The opera was Lully's Psyche, which
also known as Psyche.
People were calling it Psyche. Like, yeah. Everybody in the show was calling it Psyche. Are you going to go see Psyche tonight? But yes, it was Psyche. And it's an opera that might never be performed ever again because it requires, you know, a dance troupe, a children's dance troupe. It requires committed arte people, beautiful costumes, beautiful scenery, stage machinery, all these things. It really gives you a taste of what opera in the time of Louis XIV would have been like, and it was extravagant, you know, and this was like performed like at his house or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just
his house was Versailles, so
yeah
right.
His house is
but it was one of those things that as you're watching it, you just feel like the world is good, you know, and like that this is so awesome and that they brought so much talent on the stage to do something like that. And, you know, I read a couple of reviews of the opera. I think the Times reviewed it, and it was kind of ho-hum. But Heidi Wailson, my good friend Heidi Wailson at the Wall Street Journal, really gave a beautiful summation of what the opera was all about, and I really appreciated her review. So you should all read that. And anyway, it was just a beautiful opera, and the cast was so good and so young and so talented. And I don't know. There's this girl. Her name is Yulia Van Doren. She's a very young thing. She's from Russia. And she's like one of these knockout, like just drop dead gorgeous girls. And she's like, I promise you, she is the Anna Netrebko of the early music scene. And I mean that in the best way possible. She is from Russia too, so it works out just fine. So that's a name that you all should keep your ears out for. Carolyn Sampson and Karina Govan were the leads of the opera. And, you know, Carolyn Sampson is one of these people who has kind of found a niche for herself in early music, but she does some crossover stuff that you might be able to find her. And I mean, when I say crossover, I mean into, you know,
look,
exactly like 18th century operas. But if anybody, you know, sees her name at Borders, wherever you can buy records these days, take a listen, because, I was really quite impressed with her, and I wasn't expecting to necessarily be that impressed, but she's a beautiful woman. She's very nice and pretty. She remembered my name when.
Not to cut you off, but how was her singing?
It's beautiful. I mean,
it is okay.
Yeah, I mean the early music scene. I mean, there's a tendency for the voice to be a little bit samey, so it's really about interpretation and about, you know, your physical presence sometimes that distinguishes you. But her voice is warm for somebody who can sing a mean straight tone. And she gave a beautiful recital at 11 o'clock on Thursday night, which was the first night I got there. And I was so tired because I hadn't slept the night before.
11 in the evening?
11 o'clock at night was a recital. That's what the Boston Early Music Class was all about, like concerts starting from like 10 a.m. going all the way to midnight. It's craziness. But yeah, she gave an intimate recital at 11 o'clock at New England Conservatory. And I was so super sleepy, and I had already fallen asleep in a concert right before, and I wasn't even going to stay, but I managed to stick around for that concert, and it probably was the best thing I heard, better than the opera even. Wow. Just very, very super talented singer. And I promise you, if there were 500 people in the audience, 100 people were crying, including me, because it was such an exquisite, exquisite recital with just Theorbot, just singer and Theorbot, just the way in the oldie times.
No sackbut?
No shawm, nothing like that.
What is a sackbut anyway, Roberta?
It's a trombone.
It's a trombone.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah. You're stealing my thunder, Greg. I'm studying.
Ask Roberta.
Roberta's deep in the preparation for
placement
exams.
Well, this broke period, y'all. So.
You guys, this brings up a... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just want to say one thing to round out my summation of the Boston Early Music Festival. Sorry. And that is that, like in real estate, the lesbians know where the good things are. The lesbians have kind of claimed the early music for themselves, and every early music festival I've ever been to has
the
been...
The performers or the attendees?
Everything.
Or a nice mix of both.
Really?
The organizers, the instrumentalists, the singers, everybody. Like, the lesbians are there.
Are you sure they're lesbians? Because early music people all look like tree huggers.
I'm quite sure
they're
lesbians.
Our lesbian audience out there, I apologize.
I love the lesbians.
Where's the love in the gay world? Come on.
But in Chicago, they say that, like, the lesbians find the new neighborhoods, the gays beautify it, and then the yuppies move in. So
this
I think
is
that's
very
a,
true.
I think it's the same way with music. So people, if you want to, you know, get into the next level with your career and you want to be on the ground floor or something, find the lesbians.
Was that an iPhone in the background?
I don't know.
It was.
Oh, well, we'll have Greg's iPhone review at the end of the show as well. Okay, well, let's jump. Well, thank you, Oliver, for your...
Wait, before we run away from this.
Sure.
This brings up a very important idea to me that I don't know if you guys read Opera Chic, but there was an article a couple of things ago. I don't know when it was. Looks like yesterday even. Oh, Michael.
Why don't you mute your iPhone out before
I'm
you
trying to,
do
dear.
Our big time show.
Yeah. It says, we must never forget that true and great music goes beyond its time. Bach desires the modern organ with its innumerable registrations. Mozart asks for the pianoforte and decisively distances himself from the harpsichord. Beethoven demands our concert grand, of which Chopin is the first to develop its colors, while Debussy leaves in his preludes glimpses of the something that I don't know what it is. Therefore, the wish to restore its music to its earlier framework means the same thing as wanting to dress an adult in adolescent attire. Anybody feel anything about that?
What were you saying?
beat me to it.
Are you kidding me? The entire last half of the conversation was about historically informed practice.
Oh, of course.
Necrophilia with music, and, you know, I mean, that doesn't seem to relate to anybody.
No, it does now that you put it framed it that way. Thank you.
The necrophilia is what helped us out. Thanks, yeah, I can relate to that.
What?
Okay, sorry to be off topic.
No, I think you're right. Like, in order for us to enjoy these works, we have to try to be as authentic as possible in our presentations of them. And people like, you know, Janet Baker or whatever, or I should say Hugues Queneau, were the first to kind of introduce people to this early repertoire. And you listen to their recordings of these things, like Janet Baker singing La Callisto or something, and it's like, okay, that's pretty, but it doesn't really touch you, you know? And I think now we understand it better. I mean, this is obvious. I mean, this is obvious to everybody's listening, that, like, you know, the whole thing now about early music, especially like Handel, for example, is finding these singers who can do it well, and like finding conductors who have a sense of the style and are a little bit dancey about it, and have the flair for these things. And and now they're so enjoyable. I mean, like,
I think that everyone doesn't know that, and that's exactly what this paragraph was about, is saying that we can't impose it. Like, it's assuming that Mozart and whomever else is being performed in historically informed practice would want to hear what it would sound like now. That music is forever progressive.
Is the article, just to be clear, is the article saying that Mozart would embrace the natural evolution and improvements if they be such instrumentation and whatnot?
That's right. What it suggests.
Then that if he heard a performance that would say is suitable to modern sensibilities versus one that would sound exactly like it sounded to him 200 years ago, he would prefer the new one.
Who knows? I mean, obviously we can't answer that question.
I think if he did show up, he probably the last thing on his mind would be to go to one of his concerts.
Right.
You know, he'd want to see the iPhone and things like that.
Totally, exactly.
Maybe get something to eat at a smart restaurant.
I just wanted to be clear.
I don't absolutely love historically informed practice and performance. It's just that was a very interesting thing in the news that I wanted to bring up.
Oh, so you're saying that you advocate modernizing things.
I'm not saying that I think that one way is the only way.
Oh.
Well, we've tried both ways, so now we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I'm just playing
devil's advocate. I hate to speak for him, but there is an early music, protagonist also that appears on these podcasts, and we'll call him, for, you know, anonymity's sake, B. McGilvray.
That's way too obvious. How about Brian
That's better. And he and I were talking as I was making my way out east, and I stopped off in Ohio and spent time with him and his lovely wife. And we were talking about early music, and he was actually contending that a lot of early music is a lot of the authenticity has gone, as far as vocal technique is concerned specifically, has gone too far over to this idea of authenticity. And he believes that either through his own research or through his own aesthetics or whatever, that these operas can be performed with a little bit more of a modern technique than people realize. Would you agree that that's the case, Oliver? Or are you saying that these singers that you're hearing are they, like, was it like a modern technique? Well, would you call it an authentic technique? What you think is an authentic technique?
I know that you don't mean any offense, but I take offense to that. I think that singing straight tone is not singing with bad technique. And all of the singers that I know...
no one said bad. People said modern.
All the people that I know who do this singing well... are versatile singers and are not necessarily only able to produce one tone quality.
Well, I think what he was talking about, though, is, again, not that it is a bad technique to do that, but to take it with a more modern approach vocally than what
maybe unnecessary.
Yeah.
What we're talking about here is a really, really old debate about vibrato or straight tone in ancient music.
Maybe we can solve it tonight.
But wait, let me just put this on the table, okay? We don't know.
Let me put on a pot of coffee.
We don't have any idea how these people sing. We never will. But we have letters from Mozart to his father when he was writing his younger operas in Milan and all these other places, and he says these people use the old style, which is to sing with a tremor, and he meant vibrato. So if anything, Mozart should be performed straight tone, but high Baroque should be performed just as hoggishly as you care to. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just something that's out there right now. It's research, people are doing it, but this authenticity idea, I mean, it's great to try it out, but we don't know what this is.
I'll just say that if you can sing the notes as fast as they're meant to be sung and do it with full voice, then more power to you. But I've never heard anybody sing, you know, all these agrumon, all these mordants and coup de grace and all this stuff, like, really fast and still be able to, you know, sing Verdi at the same time. So, I don't know. I tend to favor the more pure tone. Not to say I prefer a straight tone, but there is something about that sound and that music to me that feels very, very right. And I think the lesbians would agree with me.
Good okay, for you,
here,
Oliver.
Here's a just bear with me for a second as I read through this. Here's a review of Farinelli, and it's in the midst of an article, and the paragraph before says, "It is a common error to assume that the melismatic music of Rossini or Bellini was intended to be sung with a very light, soft tone. The coloratura is intended to be sung with full appoggio, and for those that don't know, let's just call that lean, you know, full, just full tone, right? Full leaning into the voice with support, let's call it, for the sake of argument for now. All right. The musical style was different from Verdi and Wagner and therefore presents different demands, but the vocal technique was the same, as Lamperti, a very famous vocal teacher of the time, boldly states." All right. And then he puts in parentheses, "In modern times, recall that when Marilyn Horne sings Rossini's coloratura, she sang it with full appoggio." Now, here's the review of Farinelli. "All that is really necessary to convince oneself of the accuracy of Lamperti's appraisal is to read the critiques concerning the voices produced by the era of bel canto. Words have not changed that much from the 18th century. For example, Mancini wrote that Farinelli's voice, quote, was thought a marvel because it was so perfect, so sonorous, and so rich in its extent, both in the high and in the low parts of the register, that its equal has never been heard in our time. The qualities in which he excelled was in the evenness of his voice, the union of the registers, the art of swelling its sound, the portamento, a surprising agility, a graceful and pathetic style, and a shake as admirable as it is rare." Okay, that's from 1776. Now the
he was in 1776. Who did he
yeah,
play?
Great with John he was John Adams. He was wonderful. John Adams. and then he says
till
in his article,
then, "Till then, I am."
"Sir Adams, leave me alone." Anyway, agility would not have been "quote unquote" surprising had his voice been light or quasi falsetto. But the surprise is quite understandable when one notices that Farinelli's voice was described as "quote so sonorous, so rich." Words like these would be used concerning Caruso at the beginning of the 20th century. Bel canto did not produce quasi-falsetto small voices. It produced the chiaroscuro big tone of great voices. Opera presented a consistency of desired vocal quality from the 17th century until the 20th century. The changes in vocal timbre produced by the demands of verismo were slight in comparison to the many aspects of similarity. The occasional harsh tone of verismo is supported on the foundation of beautiful tone. In modern times, one needs only to remember Corelli's and Bergonzi's performances of Bellini as well as Puccini and Verdi to see the great connection of tonal quality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I don't know, when I looked at it that way, I thought, maybe there's something to this.
Sure. I mean, I understand where you're coming from with that, but do keep in mind that Handel, who is the composer for Farinelli, or one of them at least, is almost 100 years after.
Okay, so you're right. So I'm a little bit off the mark in putting
actually, Farinelli never sang for Handel.
Well, so, you know. Farinelli sang in the 18th century, and
the type, the music style, is what. Yeah,
so it's a different style.
Composers like Monteverdi and Lully are all from the 17th century. So. Mm-hmm,
correct.
So fair there's enough. You know, technique changes, you know, and like I do think that Vivaldi and Handel and composers of that genre really do benefit from being performed with, you know, appoggio, but the French monadic style and Monteverdi and stuff like that have so much wordiness, and there's very little to, you know, be flashy with, you know, and like the ornamentation really comes in quick little bursts and has to be done really, really quickly and accurately. But the words really are more important. I mean, this is the beginning of opera we're talking about, you know? Mm-hmm. Anyway, I think that our listeners are ready for some, you know, Wagner. Right
that
now,
was the so. First episode of Opera Then. But but thanks for your report, Oliver. And it created quite a good discussion, so.
Hopefully which we were not counting on.
Oliver.
Yeah, we thought the show was going to be thin, and look, you saved my ass, Oliver.
I just want you
I thought
to
it would be thin
you.
Like those singers' voices. And Greg loves you, apparently, he said.
Yes,
I absolutely do.
But he disagrees with you.
No, I don't disagree. I'm involved in a discussion.
Here's an interesting story from Crazy Ivan Katz at the Huffington Post, Opera, an Urban Art Form. In this article, he states that appreciation of opera, like a fondness for mushrooms and exotic fruits, tends to come later in life. The opera audience has always been older than the general population, and its replenishing has always relied on a steady stream of fresh blood. They have the financial meaning like 45 to 50-year-olds that have the financial means to attend opera, despite the fact... I'm zoning out here. I'm sorry. So basically what this guy is saying, though, in this article, it's interesting, is that opera is an urban art form, and reaching out to the mass audience is not something that's going to be effective. A, he brings the point up that if you want to go see an opera, you can pay a lot of money for the orchestra, or you can pay a very fair price and be up way in the balcony. If you live near Seattle, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, etc., you're not going to have a problem. But if you live in the plains of Kansas or you're in the middle of Wyoming, it's going to be difficult for you to go to see a show. So all this kind of democratization of opera is kind of it's useless. It's a useless point. He says here at the end, it's when you're talking about things like putting the Met into movie theaters and things like that. It's unlikely that video ventures will cause there to be a drop in box office receipts so long as the fundamental experience of watching a live opera is not substantially changed. But if that in-house experience is degraded or diminished, watch out. Opera audiences are notoriously quick to express displeasure by non-renewing subscriptions.
Did Kevin Keyes write this article?
This guy is Kevin Keyes' doppelganger. Every time Kevin says something, this dude comes up with something. He had the thing about the last 2 weeks. He had some articles about what the hell
opera and television.
Opera and television.
Yeah.
I mean, comparing, making the baseball comparison.
Mike sent it to me via email. And basically, in between the lines, Mike was saying, holy shit.
What if he's listening to the podcast and stealing our flavor?
He
it's
could
quite
be.
Quite possible. Yeah.
The Broadway musical is not opera. Opera to the movies.
Let's have a beer with this guy.
Yeah.
Let's see if he talks about lesbians in his next post.
Lesbians love opera.
And straight tone.
Non-straight.
Straight
they probably don't.
Opera.
Wouldn't they prefer gay tone?
Ooh. Well, so, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit behind in my news. I have to read the full article to see if this is actually something I would have said.
But it's an interesting thought that he's putting out there.
Right.
You're banging your head against a wall for nothing because, you know, at least according to him.
How is it banging your head against a wall, though? I mean, trying to reach out, I don't see a... Just because they're putting them in the movies?
I guess so. His big thing is he doesn't want it to change, so...
I think what's happening, or what we're talking about here, is like market-focused shift. And if they're really trying to make the market the movie theater house, then they're saying we have a problem. And by the same token, if you're trying to shift it from the house to the movies, you're not going to make it happen because people who go to the movies are not people who go to see operas. But I know that's not true, but what I'm saying is, the traditional demographic of a moviegoer is very different from the demographic of someone who goes to see opera regularly.
Except
there are those of us, we all go to see movies. Yes, we know.
Right. Well, except in Europe. When I was in Europe, I was astonished when I would go to a performance of one opera or another, how many young people, how many hot chicks were in the audience, et cetera, et cetera. And I just thought, I wonder what necessarily the difference is in either advertising, which everybody seems to think that's all it is. Oh, just advertise it right. But I don't really see them advertising it in any special way in Europe. Yeah, I don't see that difference. But I did notice that, here in this country, it seems to be a much older demographic, whereas in Europe, it seemed to be much more quote-unquote democratic. I think that's worth looking into, and I think it somewhat undermines this guy's argument that it will never be a broad-based thing. It's always going to be for older people with money, and that, of course, that's ridiculous.
I think he's thinking about in America.
I'm young and without money at all.
Yeah.
And I love opera.
Yeah, but... Kevin, you're also an aspiring singer. You're also a young singer. And if you were just some person,
punk.
Yeah. I don't know, because it started with a love. Right before I started playing trumpet, I loved the musicals. I loved classical music. I was into it. So who can say if I'd have developed a love with opera without getting into it? But all I know is, let's reverse it.
You could be doing trumpet now.
It was listening to an opera. It was listening to Carmen that changed my life. Right,
which they say is the first musical.
Yeah, it could be. Right. And that I remember when I first heard Carmen, I'm like, this is better than musicals. This is almost like a musical, only better. Why doesn't everybody know about this? I was so excited. But anyway, I don't know. I think he's on thin ice with this argument. I think like I said on a previous podcast, everybody who is young that I've introduced to the opera has gotten into it, and whether it continued,
in the
ticket sales.
Did they go on to buy tickets without you?
Well, no, because they live in the middle of nowhere. Okay. No, I'm just kidding.
There's the problem.
No, I was quoting his article.
Honestly, I think you're right. I think that when you're looking at the situation in America, it's quite different than.
Yeah, but it must be possible. It must be possible because that's the situation they have in Europe.
Are you sure those young people aren't just saying they like opera so they can get in your pants?
That occurred to me, but they just seem so genuine. No, I mean, there were just too many in there for it to have been a let's be seen kind of thing. And this was not the place to be seen, It was an opera in Prague, and it was Don Giovanni at the original theater where Mozart premiered Don Giovanni, and I was excited to be there, but I was also excited to be there with an audience that was largely around my age. That was exciting. It was a different energy.
When I was listening to last week's podcast, and, about the portion that I was interested in, which is Woody Allen directing an opera, it made me think about one of his films. It's a small-time crooks film. And it's a pretty recent film, and in the film, the basic idea is this: these really poor people who live in New York, this really poor couple decide that, they're going to tunnel under ground and break into a bank. And while they're tunneling, they're going to sort of have this fake business as a front. And,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have to be cut out of here, okay?
Okay.
Oh, okay. Okay, sorry.
So long, Greg.
We'll miss you.
Thanks.
But anyway, when they're sitting at home and they're poor and they're, looking forward to having all this money, the husband and wife are talking, and she's like, I don't want to be a loser all my life. I want to have money. I want to, do all these things. I want to have a nice house. She's like, can you imagine, patrons of the opera? Well, and then she starts talking about this as though it's like, the opera is far, far away from her and her potential because of the fact that, she's living the working class life now, and it's just outside of her grasp. And she looks at that in the same way she would look at, moving up in the neighborhood and owning an expensive home or expensive car. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people still are going to view opera in this way, that it's something for the wealthy or the elite. And otherwise, you're just going to feel like completely out of place, like going to a polo match. You're just going to feel like completely out of place.
I said that last week, that it's for people. I think people in this country, anyway.
Yeah, and since I wasn't here last week to comment, I mean, I even see it. You see it where you don't even realize you see it.
People, they think it's for people with monocles and top hats.
Yeah, they really do.
And
I mean,
mixed stalls.
And I think more than anything, they just are afraid of feeling completely like a fish out of water, and stupid. And like they don't belong there, so that makes them not right. interested, at least
kind of
reluctant to go to the opera. I don't know, maybe they buy recordings, which is good, but they might not attend. But that's also bad, because if you don't attend, then that affects it more than if you don't buy recordings.
Yeah,
kind of on the similar topic, isn't it amazing how many times if it comes up. And contrary to popular opinion, I am very reluctant to talk about it. But if somebody asks you what you do, there's no point in lying, and you say, oh, I'm an opera singer or something like that, they are instantly intrigued, and they just think it's the best thing ever, and they just think it's amazing. And they're like, oh, really? Have you ever seen an opera? No. It's like it sounds to everybody like something that they should like, they want to like, they could like, they might possibly like, they do like, and they've never seen it. And I just always thought that was an interesting phenomenon.
Well, do you want to know?
It's almost across the board. It's almost across
another,
the board.
I have another really funny story to tell about that. I was with somebody, this woman who's she's a nurse and she's in her 40s, and we were listening to the radio together, and she just turned it on. And when she turned it on, it was set to the classical music station here, 98.7. And they were playing, I forget what opera excerpt, it was a German opera, and so as soon as she heard it, she goes, oh, no, that's depressing, I have to change the channel. So she changed the channel. And I said, you know, I used to sing opera. I'm an opera singer. And I didn't want to embarrass her, but as soon as I said that, oh, my God, really? You know, it's switch. I'm like, you don't. She didn't realize it. She just turned it off because she thought the music was depressing. But yet, like, in the next breath, she was intrigued, you know?
Right.
And I'm like, okay, I think that people just must consider the physical, like, act of vocalizing that way just a phenomenon. But yet, they don't want to. They don't care enough to go and commit 3 hours, sometimes 4 hours.
Yeah, apparently not. That must be where the line is.
It's like for like freak shows, you know, opera singers are like, you know, freak show people to others sometimes. And it's just like, you're in awe of it, but you don't, you know, you don't care enough to really,
my
go
friends,
and experience.
My friends get in on it to get chicks. They're like, yeah, he's an opera singer. And they think that some of that's going to rub off. And, like, you know, they go, oh, we're cool, too. He's an opera singer.
Most people,
aren't you cultured and fabulous?
Most people don't realize how saturated the market is with talented people or untalented people, for that matter. And they just assume that if you sing opera, if you say you sing opera, that you are already working somewhere. And, like, I don't know why people don't put two and two together. You know, I'm waiting tables at a restaurant. And they say, oh, where have you sung before? Have I, you know, it's like, I'm, as I bring them a margarita,
you
know.
Every other weekend. They just don't pay that well anymore.
Well, you know, who knows if this is going to work. I think maybe it will. And who knows if people are going to go from the movie theaters then into the opera house itself. But one thing that we're following up with, another story we talked about several months ago, is that Archive Music, the website, keeps classical CDs in the mix. So you think the classical recording business is dead in the water? This is from the Chicago Tribune. Think again. Recent 55 out-of-print CSO titles are available now at Archive Music, ArkiveMusic.com. They are a web-based company that not only sells CDs that are in print, but something they've been doing in the last last year, I think, is they're starting to pay licensing fees for old recordings owned by EMI and Decca and things like that. And you can buy them, you can buy whole CDs, you can buy songs, and they burn them onto CDs with the original art, and they ship it out to you for, you know, about the price you pay for, maybe a dollar more than you would pay for something, but... They range from like $14.99 to $16.99.
That's a few more dollars, actually, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not that bad.
Isn't $9.99 standard or $10.99?
No, no, no.
For online?
It's like $16.99.
For online distribution?
Sure, I think so, yeah.
On iTunes?
No. Not on iTunes. You buy a CD. It's more like an Amazon. You don't buy a
digital
version.
Oh, you're actually getting the physical
CD. You're getting the CD, yes.
I'm sorry. My bad. Okay.
Not just the digital.
Right, okay.
Oh.
So
apparently it's going well for them.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And I'm a big fan of a lot of those older CSO recordings, too. Yeah. That's kind of exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Get some old Fritz Reiner.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I was just listening to Scheherazade the other day. Excellent recording.
Well done.
Well, just to follow up on the last story and how it relates to this, like, whatever people's opinions are, Ivan Katz, whoever, think about, you know, that this new way of documenting and presenting opera, if it's bad... At least it's being documented. And, you know, for, I guess, over 100 years now, there's been, you know, this thing called the gramophone that has been able to capture historical performances. And with the demise of the record industry, we need to save some of these performances of our generation. And I'm glad that even if, you know, it may have a temporary adverse effect on the performances themselves, that at least good artists are going to be kept for posterity, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a good point.
Well, hopefully it'll all work out in the end.
All of it. All of life.
You know, something tells me opera's going to be all right. Here's another story. Not really interesting. I don't really want to talk about it, but I just have seen it lately. It's kind of a trend. Strong casting at San Francisco opera performances. And again, this was in that top Yahoo Entertainment news. When you check your email or when you're on the homepage. Which is odd. I noticed it recently with when we were talking about that Hope Briggs deal, the soprano who was doing the Don Giovanni but was replaced at the last minute because they thought she wasn't up to snuff, and there were people who were crying racism, possibly. I certainly don't want to get back into that. But yeah, for some reason, it's all this news is getting up on the top of the charts.
I sent you an article, I think maybe 2 weeks ago, about some Don Giovanni, not this one, but one.
Yes, the Don Giovanni at Covent Garden.
Yeah, and like the headline of the article was just how sexy it was and how, you know, Erwin Schrott, whatever his name is, you know, how he looks good without a shirt and how everything was just so beautiful to look at. And I don't know. I mean, like, this is, it's, you know, sex sells. And like, I'm happy that, you know, the article is in the cover page of the art section of whatever, those are Times or whatever, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I'm sure Kevin has something to say about this.
You know, it's funny. When no, I was looking at that picture, I mean, he's in decent shape, but, mm-hmm. again, he's got, like, an opera hot body.
Yeah. It's opera beefcake, we say.
It really is true.
Opera good-looking or is she good-looking? Come on.
Yeah. If you took a shirt off in a movie, it wouldn't be up to – which is, you know, maybe it's unrealistic, but right. It's – even physically, there's opera good body and there's television good body. It never ends.
Yeah.
I'm leaving it. Well,
yeah. Oh, come on, Kevin.
Kevin will hold back.
Yeah, they know. Come on. I think by now.
They want you to hold back. Some people, I got some comments that people thought you lost it when you were on last. And that you're out of control. So
I figured that was going to happen.
No. Whatever. You think the singing has been good at the Met? Well, yeah, I think it's been pretty good. Whatever. You think the acting in 2005 was better than the acting in 2000? It was great. I loved it.
I'll take him on any time.
We got to have a match, Ethan, a Pitbull match.
He has no chance.
Oh, take that, Ethan.
Poor guy.
Oh, terrible. Let's see. What else is going on? Well, let's move on to some of the ridiculous items. First one we have here is that Bassey, too lazy for opera. Veteran singer Dame Shirley Bassey nearly became an opera singer, but admits she was too lazy to put in the practice. The Goldfinger hitmaker performed three songs for James Bond films. She claims that she was put off by the grueling training required of opera singers and chose to stick with her trademark big man music instead. She says, "My vocal coach said if I had the right training, I could have been an opera singer. I would have been a contralto, not a soprano. I'd have been a good candidate, but I'm basically very lazy. And opera singers have to train every day."
Yep.
Well, I mean, this was interesting that, you know, somebody's admitting that it's not such an... Just because somebody has maybe a good voice, a full, powerful voice. Because, I mean, and again, not that you have to have a full, powerful voice to necessarily be an opera. There's smaller voices. But an interesting to hear a singer admit it takes a lot. It's different to be an opera singer. You can't just walk up like Pol Pot and...
True, and maybe as true as that is, I don't think they overestimate how much people practice,
what was the point of
Well, no, that's true. I mean, obviously, people don't do it every day, always, and for whatever reason. And but there's something. My point is, it's nice to hear that she admits that there's something more to it.
Charlotte Church said the same thing. She said, "I'm going to go into pop singing. This opera is too hard."
Oh, really?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That was refreshing.
And then an angel cried that day.
Angel Records.
No, but
what happened to her lately? Anybody know?
She's the host of a talk show.
She's a hottie right now, isn't she?
Yeah, she has a talk show in the BBC or I don't know, in somewhere up there, away from America. And she's like Ellen DeGeneres, or you know, less lesbian than that. I don't know. Yeah. But
she's a lesbian?
No, but she has a talk show. You know,
there's a picture of Charlotte Church.
Really?
Manangahela.
Yeah.
Maybe she should go back to opera and be hot.
She's all grown up.
She has.
But I just have to ask a question. What
Girl,
was the point of
you,
that?
You're a woman now.
What was the point of that article? Why did Shirley Bassey come out and...
There was no point to it. It's a very short little clip. It's not really an article. It's a short little blurb. I just wanted to talk about it because it was refreshing. Very refreshing.
I do feel really fresh now.
Yeah. It was like a moist towelette at a Japanese restaurant. Or sorbet. Oh, man, I can't... Charlotte, sure. Wow. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
Help me, I have to look it up.
Hold on. I'll send it to you guys. She looks fine, but it's just... It's hard to picture her this way. Not that she's the most gorgeous thing in the world, but still.
Right.
So Shirley Bassey. Thank you, Shirley Bassey. Thank you, Leonard Bernstein.
That's right. One of the things I was going to say was just as a tag to what we're talking about, when you tell somebody you're an opera singer, like, ooh, blah, blah, blah. And then a number of them will say, God, you must be very good. And, you know, the funny thing is, I'm like, you know what? Most of us suck at this. So
wait a minute. Now here's another picture of Charlotte Church that I don't like so much.
Don't send me that one. Let me
I
keep
won't.
The dream
yeah, don't,
alive.
Don't rain on anyone's parade.
Wow. Charlotte Church.
Yeah, it's hard.
Here's a great one. In a magazine in Great Britain, the cover says Charlotte's bummer holes. There's a picture of her on her all fours, like kissing some dude in her butt. This is terrible. Here's one of her topless at a beach. Here's one of her topless just sitting somewhere.
on her talk show.
I don't know. It's like she's just sitting down somewhere. What has happened to Charlotte Church?
I don't know. I really.
Well, you know, she sees Lindsay Lohan in all those, and
but it's like she's sitting in somebody's seedy basement. It looks like fake wood paneling on the back wall, doesn't it?
There's some weed going on.
Oh my God! Why did you send that to me? What the hell?
People can't see what we see.
For those of you who are listening on your iPods and you don't have an iPhone to download this picture,
I'll make it my art album cover.
Charlotte Church is hung like a horse. I guess they don't say that about girls. I'm not good with those metaphors.
That's really kind of sad, actually.
But what is this? I don't understand the point. It looks like there's cheap wood paneling in the back, and she's saying, right. You're a really beautiful girl. You should take your shirt off so I can get everything in.
Oh, me? Okay.
Well, you know, it's girls gone wild nowadays. It's just the way it
is. They have. They've gone wild.
Girls gone wild.
That is so in right now.
Opera girls gone wild. That's what we should do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, sure.
Maybe we can get some of the sexy ladies of Opera Moda. Wow. Well, this has gone on into something else entirely, but that's kind of ridiculous, too.
It's definitely ridiculous.
Charlotte Church's nudity.
It fits.
Well, let's move on to our trademark portion.
No!
Guess who died?
No!
What's wrong, Oliver?
There was an article about that song cycle that David L. Tredici wrote, or whatever his name is, that I thought we were going to get to.
That's song cycle. This is not song cycle now. It's opera now. We'll talk about it next week, Oliver. I'm sorry. We're running down low on time. Well, okay, go ahead. Give us
For those of you who go to the website, the blog, and you can click on the delicious links, click on the thing that says song that comes from the words of friends. And it's a review of a song cycle written by David L. Tredici. And it gives a really eloquent description of what this is all about, and it talks about that it's fun, but that it's also serious, and there's AIDS, and blah, blah, blah. And, like, it sounds really interesting, but then they show this picture of this mincing homo, like, wearing a boa, like, the worst type of, like, you know, stereotype.
Yeah.
Like, they show this picture, and, like, it's just, it just really made me upset to see that picture.
It, it is pretty offensive in a way, you know? It looks, like you said, very stereotypical.
A little too gay?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It just perpetuates the stereotype, I suppose.
Yeah, it's very Will and Grace. So
and he wasn't even gay. It took a non-gay to bring gays back to set them back.
So anyway, that concludes
song cycle.
The gay portion.
So
of this
you didn't
podcast,
want to discuss the episode. You just, the song cycle. You were just. Had a problem.
Well, I mean, the song cycle is probably interesting, but I just wanted to, I really ultimately wanted to comment on how offensive that sure is. And
it's a little flamboyant.
A little.
Yeah.
Sure is. Any idiot didn't have shoes on? I mean, it's supposed to be a concert.
They're like at Carnegie Hall, and like he's wearing a boa and like.
And tube socks.
It's terrible.
That's kind of, yeah. Let's talk about the tenor, the
105-year-old
tenor. I know, let's
talk about it. Hold on, we're not the... guess who didn't die? Oliver, take it away, because you can probably pronounce this guy's name. You seem
to... Hugues Queneau is now 105. He turned 105 last Tuesday, and there was an article, I guess, on the AP or on Reuters, whatever they call that thing, about how he's 105 and how he is the oldest, you know, whatever, living opera singer, and how he, you know, sang up until he was 90 years old, and, you know, he was 84, he sang Turandot at the Met, and all this good stuff. But another thing that if you read carefully, it talks about how he has a partner who's 65 years old. Ooh. So he has a partner who is like 40 years his junior.
Robbing the cradle.
Yeah, I know. 65-year-olds, come on.
And they live in a castle.
Yeah, they're Swiss, though. So, I mean, it just makes sense. But I,
a,
I mean,
a castle each.
They
all do live in castles. They long for a bungalow.
If he's listening, or if anybody
probably with big high walls too, so he can hide in his castle and not get involved, like the Swiss.
I hope that we don't talk about him on Guess Who Died recently, because I really do enjoy.
Let's hope he doesn't make it.
Enjoy Euquenaud's career, and he had a very small voice, as this article says, and he figured out a way to put together a career with his, you know, limited vocal talent. But he was a very intelligent singer, and he and Nadia Boulanger really started the whole early music thing. You know, like, he's the first person to record the Couperin, Les Sons de Ténèbres, which is one of my favorite pieces of all time, and he's great with, you know, the Lieder repertoire and, you know, art songs and whatnot, and he also is good with the compromario roles and stuff like that. And so that's the way to go. I mean, like, if you, you know, if God gives you a lemon, you know, make a delicious limonada.
I don't think he gave him a lemon, though. I think he gave him, you know, a mandarin orange instead of
a grapefruit or tomato,
you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
or a kumquat, perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, he gave him a kiwi instead of a grapefruit. And there's nothing bad about a kiwi.
No.
Well, that good analogy.
Thank you.
You know? Well, long life to you. Hip, hip, hurrah!
But I mean, Oliver, he also touches on, he also bestows a little advice on you know, singers of today, and that is, don't shout. And I think that's fine advice to take.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we have yet to see if a lot of singers who are popular now are actually going to endure the test
to
of time.
To 105, yeah.
Yeah, even or even to 65 singing, you know, mm-hmm. in the theater. Because,
you're,
you know,
35.
Who knows if you're really, you know, if they're really singing well and not overdoing it and yelling and tackling things that are really beyond their ability right now. So,
I didn't mean to say that he had a lemon. Actually, I really love his voice. So
I mean, he had a light.
I love lemons. You know, lemons are essential.
He had a high, light, natural tenor voice that he used intelligently and effectively. And that's what any person should hope to accomplish in their career. Is to use their instrument intelligently and effectively. Wonderful.
Right. I just wonder if people, I mean, if a voice like his came along today, if would he be able to have a career is the question, you know?
I absolutely think they would. I mean, there are plenty of voices today that aren't what people would consider the most desirable, and that's not to say that they're better or worse, but I mean, you know, a lot now is just bigger, better, you know, it's like, if it's bigger, it must be better. And there are plenty of voices that are not bigger. They're not the biggest voices, but yet they are so well
used.
And I mean, the artists themselves are appealing and have that sort of je ne sais quoi, that sort of charisma that you can't really define. And it attracts people to them.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's great.
You know, like Cecilia Bartoli is a good example, I think. Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of room out there for people.
Yeah, I mean, if you were born with a gift, it'll shine through what someone else might define as a limitation. Mm-hmm. You know.
So, once again, long life. I hope you make it to 105 and a half.
Bravo.
Yeah.
And beyond.
Bravo, Bernstein.
So. Absolutely.
Bravo, Gino.
Enjoy your you know.
Enjoy that fine young man.
Yeah.
That fine young 65-year-old man you got.
That virile, vibrant, you know, boyfriend. That's excellent. This guy's doing more than one thing right, you know.
Yeah. So,
my wife will be 40 years younger than me. I'm 100.
Oh, clearly.
Yeah. And now, guess who died? This week, nobody operatic, but a guy that I like a lot, Joel Siegel, the film critic. Most recently known for, he's been on Good Morning America for a long time, ABC. Died of colon cancer. He was 63 years old. He died Friday. Always seemed like a really nice guy. Somebody who was smart, yeah. Funny, loved movies. Yeah.
And he wasn't always out to hate a movie either.
Yeah, he wasn't a basher
overly
at all.
Critical. He's a good guy. Friendly guy. Seemed nice.
Uh-huh. So.
He wasn't like of a conservative bent, was he?
You're thinking of Michael Medved.
Michael Medved, okay.
who's the movie theater critic now, who's become a right-wing.
And I also didn't know about this, but he co-founded the nonprofit cancer support organization Gilda's Club.
Yes.
After Gilda Radner died.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, something he didn't go around blabbing about, but it's also, you know.
Yeah.
Very commendable. So,
farewell. Mr. Siegel.
Sad.
I can't remember his name for a second. I blanked out.
It also seems kind of abrupt. I mean, you didn't really hear about him being ill.
I didn't know he was sick.
No, I didn't either.
So. Neither did I.
Well, we know who's sick right now.
Yeah, that's true. So, guess who died? And now we've got, you know, very bad news, as everybody out there probably knows who's listening, that Beverly Sills is very ill, apparently, with cancer. A relapse. When it comes
well, it came out of remission, right?
Came out of remission, I'm sorry, yes.
Right. Yeah.
So, and they're saying that, you know, she always plays this kind of thing very tight to the vest. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that the reason that she is announcing this to people is that because it's probably probably terminal.
Oh, yeah.
It's terrible. So she is, now she's alive, so hopefully, you know, you hope something good will come of it.
She was in remission for like 30 years. That's amazing. That is amazing.
And she's, she's a person who, she's the last big opera star, entertainment star, in the sense that, an opera singer being part of popular cultural.
Well, American, certainly.
Yeah, being part of American the pop culture even sensibility of the country. You know, she was on Ed Sullivan, and she was on the Tonight
Johnny
Show.
Carson.
Hosting the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
You don't think it's a debate that's not off topic, but whatever. So screw that, but
about
hang in there, Bev.
What? Yeah.
Don't you think Domingo is kind of, you know, has crossed over?
He's not American, though. I mean, he's not American.
You don't think so?
I don't think so, no. He's not going to host. He's never hosted The Tonight Show. He's still an opera singer. You know, it's not like when he comes out, when Beverly Sills would come out, it was almost as if people treated her, and I'm using the past tense in a sense that when she was on all these talk shows.
When she was, mm-hmm. in the public eye.
She was a guest for being a guest almost sometimes.
Like,
you know,
everybody knew that Beverly Sills was a great singer, and they never heard her sing before. You know what I mean?
And they didn't have to sit there and talk about what she thought of costumes, and you know, she would tell other stories and things like that. So
plus she was with the Muppets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love how they credit her, how she became a beloved television personality, appearing regularly on small screens with such stars as the Muppets.
They are stars.
We hope that she pulls through, though. The prognosis,
you never know. Hopefully,
yeah, you never know. But apparently, the prognosis is not good. That's the only reason we're finding out about it. So, Greg had to leave us, as some of you heard. So there goes our iPhone report. So you'll have to wait till next week.
Maybe he'll type something up and we can include it on the blog.
So I want to thank everybody for coming on. Here I thought we didn't have enough, and we're coming up on almost an hour.
Ooh.
Yeah, and I didn't even get a chance to wax prosaically about Beverly Sills, but everybody knows that I love her.
Yeah. Well, we've discussed Beverly Sills already. That's why I just wanted to make mention of her.
She will come up again, I'm certain.
Yeah, of course. Like a bubble, she will keep coming up.
Mm.
I want to thank my panel, the now missing Greg Peebles. Thank you.
Love you, miss you, mean it.
Wait a minute, that sounds hollow.
Come back to us.
Oliver Camacho.
Thank you.
Mr. Kevin Keyes.
My pleasure.
And the lovely Roberta Rice.
Yes, and thank you.
It sounds like she's, I apologize, we gotta fix the Skype deal now. Sounds like
I
you're on
tried
a telephone.
To keep kind of quiet, but
well, no, it doesn't sound bad, it's just it's hard to hear you because it sounds like you're on a phone.
As we fade out, is there something you want to plug right away, Michael?
I've got nothing to plug.
Buying things on Amazon or...
Maybe, yeah. And hey, and write us in with an email and a question for us. I liked playing viewer mail last week.
And you can always nominate us in the plug.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. You're right, Oliver. Go to operanow.blogspot.com.
Thanks, Roberta.
You mean Roberta, but that's okay. Yeah.
Who said? I'm sorry. Well, he said it.
I know. I sound like Oliver.
No, he said if you want to plug anything. Vote for us for a Podcast of the Year award. Go to our website, operanow.blogspot.com, and there's a link there for the podcast awards. And you can nominate us in the cultural arts category. You'll see the listings. You can at the top. You can click here to nominate. Follow the instructions. Let's see how we do.
Best podcast ever.
You can the voting is open until July 15th, so we've got 2 weeks from today, essentially. So get out there and vote.
Can you keep spamming votes?
No, only
no,
once.
No, but with different email addresses you can. So.
Well, I don't want to even mess that up because they could track IP addresses and then
null
everything. So.
Disqualify us?
Yeah.
For shenanigans?
So only vote once.
They'll call shenanigans?
My mother already voted twice, like the Chicago way.
From different
so
portals.
So now I'll probably lose both of the votes.
Computers. Yeah. Well done, Mrs. Rice.
So. And also visit the website, opernow.blogspot.com, email us, opernow@gmail.com, and leave us a voicemail. Nope, we're getting very few voicemails. I want to hear from you. 206-424-3617. I am your host, Michael Rice, and you've been listening to Opera Now.
You got to tell me when we're off the air.
Thanks for the save about the podcast awards, Kevin. No. I heard Oliver first, and that's I didn't hear you mention the podcast.
No, I don't mind.
You know, I can't believe we ended with Beverly Sills. Like, it's such a downer. It's like we couldn't end on a jovial, joking note because of that.
We ended on the joke of me being mistaken for you.
I guess.
Or him just disregarding you outright.
Right. Yeah.
That's an even better joke.
I thought so. That was the way I was treating it.
Yeah, thanks,
like,
everybody.
No, the woman is not capable.
I just told my buddy in Las Vegas is going to come back for me again.
Hey, for the record, before I get here, I did not hear her because she's doing the show from the bottom of a well with Baby Jessica. Okay. Can we joke about Baby Jessica now? Has it been time to heal?
It's not too soon.
Does she have gigantic tits?
Well, she was on
Tragedy Plus Time.
Morning America the other day, actually.
She was
on a morning talk show, has a baby of her own. She's only like 21 or something. She has
I'm
a baby.
Sorry, that tabloid where Charlotte Church is. I hope we're up the air now. She's going down to the guy, and he's got like the quote next to him said, "At least she stopped singing."
Well, no, she's going down to kiss him.
She is not.
Well, wait a minute. I don't think I noticed it. Then.
You didn't see that one, you guys?
I saw it, but I didn't realize.
Yeah, dude.
She's kissing him. What are you talking about?
We're talking. Okay, wait. All right, we're talking. Wait.
The Charlotte shirt when she's in the yellow bikini.
You can't see her. All you can see is her head.
She's kissing him, though.
No, no, no. You're looking at a different thing here. Let me send it to you.
I think Kevin needs to show you what he's seeing. the
bumho, that one you're talking about that one. Yeah. This is a different one.
What's going on, Tish? Poor Charlotte Church. Can Lindsay Lohan be far behind?
I think she's leagues ahead.
Oh, I think I see the one you're talking about now.
Okay.
You can see her eyes and her hands on her behind or something?
Here. You'll see what I mean. It came up pretty much right away.
We're turning into Charlotte Church talk.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sex does sell, so this is probably going to be the best downloaded podcast ever.
Yeah. What? It should get 1,000 hits now.
Yeah. You put a picture of it on the blog, I bet you.
I'll make her my album.
With little stars over her nipples, you know?
Yeah.
Or little Opera Now logos over her nipples. Yeah.
Sandwiches or something.
Same
I think it was on the one that you sent me. But
come on, Kevin, you're killing me here. Is the one where she's flipping somebody off?
No.
I've seen
one of
two
these
pictures of her flipping people off. She's lost it.
That's gotta be in here. It's gotta be in here.
So I was saying that the last podcast had like so much testosterone. I'm glad that I was able to bring it back down today. But now you guys are looking at
Roberta has
online.
A ton of testosterone.
No, she wasn't on the last one.
I thought you were. Oh, you were.
No.
Oh, was it the most recent one?
Right out.
Cha!
very well-received show. A lot of downloads so far. It's
Fail Right Out?
Like 4 or 5 days, yeah.
Excellent.
Very exciting.
Where was I? I can't remember.
You were at my birthday party.
Yeah, you guys were at
Virginia.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask how that went. Mike, did you sing Dappertutto?
Oh, no, we didn't do his birthday party.
No, that's later on. When are you going to be in Chicago? We'll plan it around you.
Wow.
Kevin, when are you coming to Chicago?
I'm coming in September for my parents' 50th.
Oh,
okay, you're kidding.
Not at all.
Oh.
Are you going to screw up the words to the Toreador song again for her for his present?
I don't know why you had to go there. That was...
That was...